better staying awake and planning my next move. I woke up exhausted, with no appetite and little hope. But I knew what I had to do next. I knew where to go and how to get there. My first destination was Ray Ray Wanamaker and Company on the south side of Central Park at 11:45 a.m. Ray Ray's brother, Brill Wanamaker, was a bus driver for the city of New York. He worked hard and had many commendations from the city, his union, and private commuter organizations that judge public transportation and those who deliver it. Brill was a bastion of good, but his brother, Ray Ray, was just bad. His first stint in prison was for drug dealing. His second conviction was for attempted murder. And his final period of incarceration was for stealing an ambulance. No one, not even Ray Ray, it seemed, could figure out why he stole that emergency vehicle. When he was in for the third time, Brill decided to save him. He bought a fleet of 5 defunct buses and worked diligently rebuilding them while Ray Ray languished in Attica. Upon the career criminal's release, his brother presented him with a ready-made business that would ferry family and loved ones directly to the prisons where their blood, kinfolk, and friends were interned. Love is a powerful tool. I believe that Ray Ray rehabilitated, not because he had a good-paying business, but because of the idea that his brother worked all those years just for him. Ray Ray got a license to drive a bus, hired a staff of mainly ex-cons, and worked 7 days a week transporting spouses, family members, and other lovers to see their unlucky kinsmen for a minimal price. I took off my fake facial hair, donned a yellow hoodie, and made my way to the makeshift bus stop that the NYPD had been ordered to let operate so as not to incur political rancor from proponents for prisoner rights. Most of Ray Ray's clients, to most prisons, were women and children, mothers, and now and then a brother or father. But Bedford Hills Correctional Facility was the only maximum security female prison in the New York penal system. So there were a good number of husbands and boyfriends sprinkled in among mothers, grandmothers, grown daughters, and children. When I climbed up into the entry well of the old-time bus, I had my $17.50 in hand, ready to pay and ride in relative anonymity.
"Joe?"
the driver said.
"Lenny, you got somebody at Bedford?"
"Private now. There's someone I need to talk to."
"You're lucky Ray Ray don't drive this run,"
Lenny the lookout said. He was a skinny white guy with dirty blonde hair and skin something like an albino crocodile hide.
"Why is that?"
"'Cause you busted his ass more than any other cop. He told me that you could never get on this bus."
"And?"
"I won't tell if you won't."
"That'll be $17.50.
"You going to see your wife?"
A plump black woman with a beautiful face asked me. She had the window seat and I the aisle. A friend of a friend. He can't be seen up there, and so I deliver the message.
"Conjugal visit?"
"I don't think my friend would appreciate that."
"You don't have to know,"
the brown-faced Aphrodite explained.
"I mean, if a man can't come up and give her what she needs, he should be happy he got a friend that'll do that for him."
"If he could be happy about that, then he wouldn't be in so much trouble that he can't be seen."
"He don't have to know,"
she said again. "Leonard Piller," I said, extending a hand.
"Zenobia Price,"
she replied, accepting the proffered hand.
"I've been up to see my sister's husband in arsoning 5 times. She in jail for the same robbery up here."
"What would you do if your man came up to service your sister?" She thought a moment, and then grinned. The gap-toothed smile reminded me that the letter from Minnesota had resexualized me.
"I'd cut off his dick, take Athena's kids, and move to Lake Tahoe, the Nevada side where I could deal cards for a living."
Before we got off the bus, Zenobia gave me her phone number, and I gave her one that might seem like it was connected to me. Bedford Hills Correctional Facility was a group of old brick buildings separated from the world by high-wire fences and enough razor wire to protect Fort Knox. I let Zenobia enter before me because I didn't want her to hear my real name.
I lied about who I was going to see and my name because I wanted to linger someplace with Zenobia Price. I wanted to smell her sweat, but I knew that I had to hold back some, or soon I'd be in some deconsecrated crypt, stacked with strangers and eaten by rats. Name? The front gate lookout asked. Even though she was sitting, I could see that she was tall, her skin white like aged ivory. The sentry did not smile within the confines of the prison, but she didn't seem dour. Joe Oliver. Inmate you're coming to see, including her number and the number we gave allowing your visit? Lauren Bachnall. The officer, who had not been looking at me, raised her head. There is no inmate here with that name.
Not an inmate, I said.
The assistant warden.
And who are you?
I already told you that. The sentry was confused. The words I gave her didn't have a corollary in her rule book.
Step to the side, she said to me. Mary, this man needs assistance,
she called to another woman, sitting behind a metal desk maybe 15 feet away. Mary had broad shoulders, and when she stood up, I had the feeling of being faced by a man. She was very upset to have to deal with hoi polloi like me. I imagined she was once the custodian on duty for visitation, and now she had risen to a more supervisorial rank.
Yes, she said to me.
Rather than calling her a black woman, I would have used the descriptor caramel buttercream. Together her fists would have been the size of my head, and I had no doubt she was close to using those hands on my jaw. My name is Joe Oliver, and I'm here to see Lauren Bachnall. Assistant Warden Bachnall has a secretary and a phone. And yet, here I stand, talking to you.
I can't help you.
I'll tell Lauren that when I call from the phone booth outside. Mary didn't like me. Most people don't. I push them and then make them do things that insult their sense of independence. Since my own stint in prison, I especially enjoyed making prison guards into pretzels.
What's your name again?
The woman named after our savior's mother asked. I told her.
Wait over there,
she ordered, waving at a battered pine bench made for no more than two. Sitting there, I wondered about my life up until that moment. Those many years I had progressed steadily, but always on the wrong path. As a lone wolf cop and a resentful PI, I was spry of step, but blinded. It occurred to me that my whole life had been organized around the guiding principle of being completely in charge of whatever I did. Gladstone understood this. That's why he helped me become a PI. The problem was that no man is an island. No man can control his fate. No woman either, or gnat, or redwood tree. There I was at a women's prison, looking for answers I didn't want, propelled by forces I could not control. For some reason, this revelation made me smile. It was as if a great weight had been taken from me. The question was no longer if I might fail, but when.
Mr. Oliver?
I looked up to see Mary and a smaller woman who had bronze-red skin. Mary's uniform was dark blue and imposing, where the smaller guard's costume consisted of a tan blouse and black trousers. She wore a belt that had a truncheon and pepper spray hanging from one side, and a walkie-talkie attached to the other. Yes, Mary, I said. She frowned, then glowered, then said, The assistant warden will see you. Riata will show you the way. The short guard walked me to an iron gate, opened the door with a keypad combination, and then led me down a long brick hallway that had no doors. We came to another door that needed deciphering, and then across a grassy courtyard where three prisoners were doing gardening work. The inmates wore gray uniforms that, for the most part, hid their figures. They looked at me with interests that ranged from come hither to stay away. The guard named Riata did not speak to me or anyone else on our journey. We passed maybe 18 prisoners, three women guards, and two men. Finally, we came to a door that had both a sentinel and an electronic lock. Riata passed both tests and then shepherded me through and to a gray-green elevator door. When we got there, the door opened, revealing a chamber that no more than 3 bodies might inhabit.
Get in,
were Riata's first and last words to me. I experienced a sudden pang of fear. I was no longer in New York City, but for all I knew, there was a warrant out on me for murder. And here I was in a state prison. The door closed, and a motor hummed. The chamber moved at a pace that was so slow, I didn't feel it. 2 minutes later, the door slid open, and there before me stood a familiar face.
"Hello, Your Majesty," she said.
Lauren Bocknell had been a green recruit in the halcyon days of my police career. Her hair could be called either red or blonde, and her gait was graceful, if not quite feminine. She was tall for a woman, her face was broad, and her skin as pale as any Scandinavian's. Her body, in a uniform-like dark blue pantsuit, was a bit wider than when I last saw her, but I was not fooled. I had seen her lay low an angel-dusted 6-foot man with one punch. "I'm just a civilian now," I said. She turned with military precision, and I followed. We went into an office that had large barred windows set within 3 of its walls. The desk was pale green, constructed from plastic of some sort. There was a computer on a side table and a blue blotter with not even a pencil in sight. Laura, that's what I called her when we worked together, had always been inordinately neat, maybe even a little obsessive. She sat behind the desk and I took the hot seat across from her. She gave me a big smile.
"What brings you out here, civilian?"
she asked. "Looking for a woman?"
"You always were."
"Work," I said. Lauren liked me. I never saved her life or even taught her very much, but I treated her like a partner, and not all men did that on the force in our day. Today either.
"Name?"
she said.
"Lana Ruiz."
Lauren cocked her head to the side like she used to when we were partners, and my voice modulated when talking on the phone to a lover, or at least a potential lover.
"No,"
I said to her unspoken question. "She has information about something that I need for a job."
"What?"
"Believe me, darling, you don't want to know." Lauren let a beat or two pass and then reached into a drawer from which she extracted a phone receiver. Beyond my line of sight, she entered a few digits and then said,
"Have Lana Ruiz brought to my meeting cell?"
She put the phone away and considered me. I honestly had no idea what she was thinking. Even though I love the company of women, I can't claim to understand them very well.
"My husband left me over you,"
she said after quite some time of silence.
"Say what?"
"He said that every time I came off a shift with you, I was all sexy and did things that I never had before. He said he didn't realize it at the time, but after you and I were reassigned to new partners, he said I hardly even touched him. And when I did, there was no feeling to it."
"Is that true?" I asked.
"You made me realize something about myself, Joe."
"What's that, Laura?"
"Well?"
She hesitated.
"It's like this. I'm definitely a heterosexual woman. I like men's parts and how they use them, but the world that men imagine themselves living in has nothing to do with the world I know. Their football games and physical violence are just stupid to me. And even though you were one of those men, when we were together in that cruiser, I could imagine a life in a world maybe 100 years from now where my ideas and some man's might be the same."
Our eyes met and the phone sounded. Lauren picked up the receiver, listened, and then put the phone away.
"Get in the elevator and it will take you to Lana. When you're through, knock on the door and the guards will take you back to clearance."
"What about what you were telling me?" I asked.
"That was then," she explained.
"And this is now," I argued.
"My new husband has given me a daughter,"
she said with a friendly look on her wide features.
"And as many times as I imagined you when I was with George, I'd never upset Cynthia's apple cart."
I nodded and stood.
"No one will be watching or listening in on you and Lana," Lauren assured me.
Moving as slowly as it did, I couldn't tell if the lift was taking me up or down. But when the door opened, I found myself facing a riveted metal portal guarded by 2 women, both of whom were equipped with sidearms and batons. One was brown, and the other near black.
"You here for Ruiz?" the darker-skinned guard asked.
"Yes." The questioner's partner unlocked the metal door and pulled it open. I walked through into a room similar to Lauren's meeting cell. The only furniture was a solitary table and two chairs. A young woman in a gray uniform was looking out the barred window over the tops of trees. She turned, saw me, and frowned.
"What is this?"
she asked.
"My name is Joe Oliver," I said. "I'm a private detective investigating the conviction of a free man."
"You think they could kill him two times?"
"I'm trying to prove that Detectives Valance and Pratt had targeted the Blood Brothers of Broadway and finally got killed trying to bushwhack Mr. Mann."
Lana was 5'5", with dark brown skin and hair that was straight and coarse due to hard water and substandard hair products. She was handsome the way beautiful women get after they pass the age of 40. But she was a young woman, in her late 20s, aged by prison and a life that charged more than it gave back.
"Come have a seat," I offered.
She sneered, and then wondered, finally taking one of the battered wood chairs at the sad and slender table. Sitting down across from her, I noticed that she'd bitten her nails. She saw what I did and put her hands in her lap.
"Manny," she said. It might have been a mantra.
"How did you get here to me?"
"I got your name from a court document," I said. "But before I came here, I met with Lamont Charles. He sent me to see Miranda Goya, and she pointed the way to a guy named Theodore."
"Who?"
"Burns."
"Oh."
A twinge of sadness crossed her features.
"That kid was a sad case. How is he?"
"So high he could peek into heaven."
The phrase brought a smile to her face. She sat back in the chair and assessed me.
"What you want?"
"Can you give me anything that might put a bright light on what Valance and Pratt were up to?"
"Not if I ever want to see my little girl again."
Cecilia,
Lana said in a rolling Spanish lilt.
"She's 4 now, and with my mother. Yolo Valance told Billy Makepeace that if I stayed quiet, I'd get out of here before she gets to high school."
"Valance is dead."
"Yeah, but him and Anton had connections that want all that shit they did kept quiet."
"Can you tell me who?"
"I don't know no names, but even if I did, I wouldn't be saying them."
"Who's this Billy Makepeace?"
"A cop I was banging."
"He was your lover?"
Lana smiled at me.
"If it was nothing, then why would he help you with a dangerous man like Valance?"
"He couldn't come with a condom on, and sometimes we'd get a little high, so maybe I'd let him."
And then came Cecilia.
"Manny didn't want me seeing no cop, but I needed things that Billy wanted to give me. He paid my rent half the time and fooled himself to think he was in love with me. After I had the baby, he had the test done, and he didn't want his daughter's mother killed."
"He knew about what Valance and Pratt were doing?"
"Everybody knew,"
she said, as disgusted with the human race as Laura had been with men. "You think he'd consider making some kind of testimony about that?"
"Would you?"
she sneered. It was such a good question that I fell out of my role as investigator for a moment or two. In order to be a cop, a good cop, you have to be ready to put your life on the line at any moment. Most cops had families and futures to think about. They acted as if those who break the law had put themselves in jeopardy. But that's not the case with me. Melquoth could tell that. So could my daughter.
"They don't have no cameras in here,"
Lana said.
"The assistant warden told me."
"You want to do it, sitting in that chair?"
The question on my face made her smile. She stood up, sat on the table, and spread her trousered legs.
"We could do it like this, if you want."
"I'm old enough to be your father," I argued, in spite of the sweat at the back of my neck.
"You could be my baby daddy, too."
"What about Billy?"
"He ain't here."
"I don't have a condom."
"They got this thing called the Family Center Program at Bedford Hills. If I get pregnant, I get 9 months care and then get to spend at least a year with my baby. Cecilia need a little brother or sister. After that, I'd be out in less than 2 years. "Billy's marriage went dry," Lana coaxed. "He can't say nothing about me getting laid. Shit,
Do you know what it's like up in here?
I certainly did. My breath came funny, and I was certainly aroused. But the thought of Asia kept my zipper up. I was old enough to be Lana's father, and I would act the part. I took $700 of Augustine Antrobus's money and handed it to the young woman. I have a daughter, I said, in answer to the confused frown on the blood sister's face. I love her more than this life or the next.
We could do something else if you want.
How about telling me how to get to Billy Makepeace? 31.
Mr. Makepeace, I said, when he answered the phone. I was seated in the last row of the bus in a solitary seat across the aisle from the toilet.
Who is this?
A man said.
How did you get this number?
Lana wondered if you had gone to see Cecilia.
Who is this?
William Makepeace demanded.
A friend of a free man.
I imagined that in the barrier of silence, Billy was wondering if he should just hang up.
Tell me who this is.
I want to know if you're willing to testify against two dead men, set the mother of your child free, and maybe keep an innocent man from getting executed. Another spate of silence.
Whoever you are, he said, I am an officer of the law, and your threats constitute a crime.
Not if you know about a private graveyard maintained by Officers Valance and Pratt. Not if there's even a shred of suspicion that you knew what they were up to.
Who is this?
Like I said, a friend of Manny's.
What about Lana?
She asked me to ask you about your daughter when I said I wanted to know why she wasn't dead like the rest of her friends.
I don't know anything about what you're saying,
he said flatly. Then he hung up. I pulled up the window and threw the phone onto the highway. There's a liquor store 5 blocks from the underground bunker on 73rd Street where I was hiding. There I bought a liter of Hennessy, extra old, and then made my way into the sleeping crypt. On a shelf in the studio, I found a turquoise plastic drinking glass that held maybe 3 ounces. I filled it with cognac, drained it, then filled it again. After 4 drinks, my lips and fingertips were tingling. I stumbled up the stairs and out of the hideaway into the street. I walked, almost without a misstep, down to the theater district, where I found an electronics store that sold disposable phones. I bought 3 of these. At a popular coffee shop chain store, I ordered a huge cup of dark roast coffee, which I had no intention of drinking. I jiggered one of the temporary phones to life and started making my late-night calls.
Hello?
Asia Denise Oliver said in a tremulous, sleepy tone. It's me.
Daddy.
You okay?
Uh-huh. Tomorrow we're gonna go to Disney World, and Coleman says we could all go fishing if we want.
I was relieved that she was so far away.
You aren't calling your friends, are you? No.
Nobody?
This one guy I met at the roller rink in Dumbo called my real phone. I told him I was down with relatives in D.C. for 2 weeks. Nobody knows I know him, though.
I love you, girl.
Mama's here. She want to talk to you.
There was a rustling sound, and then, Joe? Hey, Monica.
Are you all right?
Rage sparked at a place very near my dinosaur brain. There was a time when my wife could have shielded me from the terrors of Rikers. She could have put up the money, and I might have escaped the brunt of my late-night terrors.
Joe?
She asked again. I'm fine.
Can you tell me what's going on? Did my call really bring all this down?
Not completely. I mean, I could have become a plumber, I said. I just didn't want her angry with me. There was no need to torture her, no matter how deep my pain.
Why are you calling?
She asked. Because my little girl's voice is like penicillin for my wounds. I felt a little eddy of giddiness twist through my mind. The alcohol was increasing its hold.
We're fine, Monica said. Coleman is protecting us.
I sent 2 texts after saying goodnight to Asia. 12 minutes later, my temporary phone rang.
Hey, Effie. Joe?
Yes, ma'am.
What's this phone?
I'm in a little trouble.
You need me?
There was something in the tenor of her question that sent a chill through me. It was something beyond love, all the way back to when humanity was a group animal connected by experience deeper than any memory. I've been thinking about you, the cognac in me said.
What?
You don't owe me anything, F.
Only my life, baby.
I stood up from the small table and walked toward the front door of the coffee emporium. People, I felt, were staring at me. I think I was able to walk in a fairly sober fashion, but the liquor was getting stronger. Maybe so, I said into the tiny receiver. But you kept me from crash and burn whenever I called. I needed a woman to be there, and there you were. She was silent for a moment or two, and I was trying my best to walk a straight line up 8th. People were moving in sober gates all around me. I was worried that some cop might see me and bring me down.
Where are you?
Effie asked. Nowhere.
Do you need me to come there with you?
I love you, Effie, was all I could say. She gasped over the airwaves and into my soul. Damn, I was drunk. It took 4 blocks to explain that I wanted a new relationship, that I loved her, and maybe we could be friends. She told me that at first I saved her from prosecution, and then when I let her in when I was down, she was able to use me like a life raft through her own troubles. Together, we had navigated into safer waters. We disconnected when I got to the front door of my hideaway. Ensconced in the apartment, I poured another glass of cognac and drank it at the sink. Then I served up another and went to sit on the single mattress cot that passed for a bed. The ceiling of the underground room was low. I could feel it pressing down on my head. The room was spinning, but that wasn't too serious a problem. I could ride that whirlwind, too. But there was a certainty in my mind that I was going to die in the morning or maybe the day after. Someone was going to kill me. I remember feeling nauseous. I thought I was going to throw up and tried to lurch from the bed, but instead I fell sideways into an unconsciousness that contained entire scenarios of me shot, killed, drained of blood, and bunged into a coffin. The ringer on the temp phone started at a note in the lower register and then climbed higher and higher for 16 tones. The last and longest chime was a little piercing. I know the musical scheme so well because it rang 3 times somewhere after 4 a.m. The first series of notes reminded me of a stream making its way across the floor of my underground cave. There were fish in there and a mountain lion somewhere above looking to take me down if I tried to drink water. The second call was a shimmering wall of lights that resonated with the tinkling sounds. Halfway through the third attempt, I sat up straight, snagged the phone from the floor, and cried, "Who the fuck is it?" "How's it coming, King?" Melquoth Frost murmured in my ear. "Mel, you okay?" "That might be a little optimistic, but I'm not dead." "How's the room?" "I expect a big red devil to bang the door down and take my soul any minute." "Why are you calling me?" "You're the one texting me your number. It couldn't wait until the sun came up. I was working on this spring-driven wooden clock from the 1700s when it hit me."
"The clock hit you?"
"I was just talking, trying to keep from throwing up."
"If you cross the line and the cops are after you, I got a plan."
"Plan for what?"
"For you."
I thought about standing, realized I couldn't, then leaned back against the cold brick wall behind the bed. The chill went some way toward rejuvenating me.
"Talk on," I said.
"Man is dead no matter what way you look at it, and the police department is never going to admit the cops as bad as Balance and Pratt. Neither will they admit to framing you. You're a bug to them, and we all know what happens to a bug when he gets between a rock and the hard place."
"Doesn't sound like much of a plan, Mel."
"I know a dude down in Panama could make a whole baseball team disappear.
All I need is a plane, and that's just some money.
We talked longer, but I don't remember what was said. I hadn't been that drunk in a very long time, and I hope never to go that far again.
32. Languishing in the darkness of semi-consciousness, creeping danger, and certain death, I felt the splash of a drop of water on my forehead. If I were the Wicked Witch, that would be the sign of my undoing. I would die, and the war of flying monkeys would be over. My gut felt like a flagging dirigible, and the pain in my head was a brick wall, solid and everlasting. Another tiny splash. That was one of the tears on my neck when Asia hugged me after I'd been let out of Rikers. I cried, too, because I was so happy to be loved.
"Are you okay, Daddy?"
she asked. It felt as if she were in that room with me, and we were crying together. The next drop brought to mind the rainstorm I was caught in the third grade, walking home from school. It had been gray all day, but no one had told me it might rain. I gave up protecting my homework and my books. The spring rain soaked through my clothes. It was cold and set me to shivering on the cot where I lay. I remembered slogging through the downpour toward my grandparents' house. There was no other choice. When I got there, my grandmother put my clothes in the dryer so that when I put them on again, I'd be warm and toasty. There must be a leak above the bed. That's what I thought. I didn't want to get up in the middle of the night to fix it, so I turned on my side and moved closer to the wall. All I wanted was unconsciousness. The next drop landed in my left ear. I shot up straight, voicing a wordless complaint. When I opened my eyes, I saw that the lights had been turned on, and that the leak was actually a man with an eyedropper torturing me like some minor demon from Dante's hell.
"Glad," I cried. "What the fuck, man?"
He'd pulled a chair up next to me and used one of the blue plastic juice glasses for his store of torture drops.
"At first I thought you were dead, brother," my oldest cop friend claimed. "Then I smelled the XO."
"How'd you find me?"
I noticed that he was wearing all black.
"I put out the question on my Facebook and got a message from Lauren Bocknell that you had just left Bedford on Ray Ray's commuter line. All I had to do was set up across the street and wait for you."
The hangover that I thought would never leave drained out of me in less than 60 seconds. It was a matter of life and death in that room with Gladstone. Mostly death. It all came clear to me right then. I understood what happened to me and why. I knew what the verdict was, too. I looked at my brother in black and asked, "Are you here to take me out?"
"That's what they said. Not for the first time, either."
I considered attacking him, but knew better. He could have put a bullet in my skull rather than those drops on my head.
"You were in league with Little Exeter and his crew?"
"Not me. They just called me up and said that you were a dead man."
"Why call you?" I asked, even though I knew the answer.
"Nowadays, I'm kind of a clearinghouse under the new mayor and chief. They want to clean up the past and start the future with a blank slate. But back then, it was a kind of club that shared all that money swirling around. My nephew was in law school, and I bought my wife a house in Miami. I had told my friends back then what you were up to, and they decided to make you die."
"But you gave them a better choice," I said.
"I knew you and the ladies, Joe. I knew we could put a frame around you with a cute young white girl. Worked beautiful. But Convert is a pervert. He made it so Jocelyn Breyer got the case and turned Monica against you. I had it so you'd make bail, and then I'd talk you into accepting what had happened. But after you got slashed, I just put you in a hole and let the powers that be do what they did."
"So you destroyed my life," I said. "Just like that."
"I saved your life, Joe. Don't you ever believe anything else.
But now you're going to come in here and kill me."
"When I saw you come in this building, I knew you had taken Mr. Thurman's hideaway," he said. "We've known about this place for a while. How'd you know about it anyway?"
"Are you going to kill me, Glad?"
"Do I have to? I'm a cop, man. I saw something bad, and I took steps. Your people wrecked everything. You're an ex-cop, Joe. And who knows?
Maybe if you stayed on the job, you'd have gotten shot down in a firefight or something. It could be I saved your life twice.
It was wrong what you did. Maybe. Gladstone Palmer admitted.
Maybe. But you have to understand, Joe. The brass now is all new. The people I worked with are off the force.
Paul Convert's still around.
He's not going to be a problem long. After he messed up in Queens, he's in more hot water than you.
You know about Queens?
After the fact. Glad's smile was friendly, if sad. The force can't afford a scandal, Joe. The people dealing on the docks are either retired, dead, or reformed. Not even the mayor would stand in the way of your demise.
Gladstone had a way of revealing the truth.
I could see that. I'd never be exonerated,
much less reinstated.
And there's another thing,
my friend said.
What's that?
I asked. A wave of exhaustion passed through me.
This thing with Free Man, Leonard Compton?
How you know about him?
I'm looking for you in a whole other precinct. You're kicking up dust over a cop killer. You know, the left hand speaks to the right, even on the dark side of the force.
Valance and Pratt killed over a dozen people, Glad.
I know.
You do?
Everybody knew about Valance and Pratt. But nobody kills a cop unless it's the last resort. And you know those boys made a lot of money. They could grease the wheels of machines half the way to Albany.
That's wrong, man.
Yes, it is. But that's not the question.
Then what is?
Do you need me to kill you right now?
There was no smile on my old friend's lips. I couldn't remember him ever without at least a hint of a grin somewhere on his face. I took the question seriously, and somewhere in the depths of my mind, an answer rose to the surface like the carcass of some long-dead deep-sea creature.
No, I said. No.
Sleep came with my last negation. I don't remember whatever else Glad might have said. I don't remember him leaving my subterranean cell. I just passed out, unable to defend or save myself. But in that deep repose, the answer to my quest remained in light. I couldn't repair my career. I couldn't achieve a reprieve for a free man. All I had was the truth and the certainty that I had to do something about that truth. If that meant breaking the law, I was ready. If it meant missing my child's graduation, that would have to be. 33. The hangover returned, with consciousness, but it wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been. The only after effects were jitters in my extremities. I got out of bed, used the water closet toilet, and sat in the chair that my old friend and near assassin sat in to sprinkle water on me. It all started with a letter from the Midwest. My life was in shambles, but sometimes you had to break things down to see what was wrong. I knew what to do, and half the way to do it. It wasn't so much a plan as it was a suicide mission aimed at the heart of enemy territory. I was now an enlightened terrorist, planning to show the all-powerful enemy that I could hurt them, that I could take away their shiny baubles and false judgments.
Mel, I said when he answered the phone.
My liege?
It was 10:16 a.m., and I was at the coffee emporium again. This time, I drank what I bought. Am I right that you sit around working on timepieces all day? That and thinking about sticking it to the law?
Every hour of every day, he said. Rain or shine, sound asleep or wide awake.
I like your plan about that baseball team escaping to Panama, but I need to add a little to it. We talked for more than an hour, during the first 30 minutes of which my new best friend was quite leery. But by the end, I had brought him around to my way of thinking. Around 11:30, he expressed an excitement that could only mean that something bad was bound to happen. It was chilly that morning, but I still had my heavy disguise coat, so I wandered down until I came to a Times Square street that the previous mayor had blocked off so that touristical pedestrians could stroll freely and sit on benches placed here and there. He answered the call on the first ring.
Hello?
His tone was anything but
confident.
Mr. Braun, I said. Tom Bowl here.
Bowl? He whined. What do you want now?
I misled you in the beginning, Mr. Brown. I wasn't hired to find Johanna Mudd, but to prove your case that a free man was innocent. My clients had heard that you were backing off, and they wanted to keep that engine running.
Man?
Yeah. I found Johanna, too. She's dead on top of a heap of dead bodies provided by the cops your client killed.
I had nothing to do with any of that.
You sent men to kill me.
Marmot told me he was going to threaten you, that's all.
And you believed him?
You don't understand what you're doing.
No, sir. I do understand. You might not like it that I passed the black mark back to you by telling Marmot's boss that you hired me to indict him, but that doesn't make me ignorant. All I did was turn the focus on you.
Not me, you idiot. My daughter.
What about your daughter?
The reason I backed off the man case was because they took my daughter. They have her somewhere, and they said unless I do as they instructed, that she'd be hurt and then killed.
Marmot said this?
Yes.
And Antrobus?
I don't know that name, but now that you told them you're looking into Marmot for me, they say they're going to kill my little girl.
The bane of police work is innocent bystanders. You try your best, but unseen events, ricochet bullets, and false arrests are a part of the job. I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Braun. I mean, all I knew was that you were about to wreck man's case, and then you set me up to meet two assassins. If I knew about your child, I would have done something else. He was quiet on the line. I have some questions, I said, in a mild tone.
Why should I answer?
Because I'm probably the only hope you have of getting your daughter back. He took in and released three breaths, then said,
What do you want to know?
How old is your daughter?
7,
he said, and then he cried some. I will get her back for you if you set up a hearing for Mann in Manhattan. It'll have to be sometime next week.
How can you get my daughter?
How did I get to you?
I'll do as you say if you agree to free my daughter first.
No, Mr. Braun. This is the deal. You set up a meeting between a group of people of my choosing and Mann. After that, we will bring your daughter to you.
Who are you working with?
Deep talent, Mr. Braun. Deep talent.
I can get a court date set, he admitted. But I've been told by people who know that it will be impossible to change the verdict unless I prove that he didn't pull the trigger. And I don't care how much you investigate, Mr. Ball. You will not prove that. I grieve over Ms. Mudd, but you cannot save her either.
I appreciate your honesty, Mr. Braun. If I'm about to partner up with somebody, I expect honor. But don't worry, sir. All we need is a free man in a downtown holding cell. You won't be required to prove the impossible or raise the dead.
I'll try to set the hearing for Monday. I know a judge who owes me a thing or two.
I'll be in touch.
All I care about is Chrissy, Mr. Ball.
I understand. I have a daughter, too. I can't even imagine how you must feel. But you stay true to me, and you two will be eating ice cream sundaes by Wednesday night. The outside bench was getting chilly, so I walked over to Grand Central just to warm up. I went upstairs there to the steakhouse and ordered a porterhouse steak, medium well, with thick fries and French beans.
Hello?
A jaunty voice answered on the other end of my third and final phone call. Was that you last night, or just a dream? I asked.
Was I handsome and witty?
I guess.
Then that was me. What can I do for you, Joe?
What do you know about Augustine Antrobus and William James Marmot?
This is that free man thing, right?
Gladstone Palmer surmised.
Joe, you cannot exonerate a man who killed two cops. Sherlock Holmes couldn't do shit like that.
I know, I said, and I accept it. But, you know, I stepped on a few toes before you enlightened me, and now I have to do some housekeeping.
You'll stop trying to get man exonerated?
If Convent stays off my ass.
I'll send you what files we have by email. But, Joe.
What?
I can't save your ass every time you step out of line.
The files came before my stake. I couldn't read them on my cheap phone, but that didn't matter.
I forwarded them to Mel with a note and started on my steak. They seated me next to the outer wall of the dining area. From there I could look down on the rotunda as thousands of commuters, civilians, cops, and some crooks passed through. There rose a senseless, very human hubbub from below while I ate my red meat and plotted against the state.
Ferris,
he answered on the third ring. Hello, Mr. Ferris. Joe Oliver here.
Hello, my boy. How are you?
It's the 15th round of an old-time boxing match, I said. I've lost every minute of every round up till now, but I think I finally see a way to get my hook past his defense.
It's hard to find the talk to hurt a man that late in a fight,
the world-wise multi-billionaire opined. Don't I know it.
What can I do for you, son?
Is there some music event going on tonight that you'd like to see with my grandmother?
There's an invitation I have to hear three of Mozart's four-handed sonatas in the upstairs chamber at Carnegie Hall.
If you want, I'd be happy to go with you and bring my grandmother along.
That would be wonderful.
Then it's done, I said.
And what can I do for you?
A huge favor for me, I said. I hope not so much for you. We discussed an impossible task for all of 4 minutes, at the end of which Roger Ferris said,
I've been a crook all my life, Joe. It's nice to know I could use that talent to do something right.
Can I come casual to the event? I asked. I have a chore or two before the performance, and I might not be able to make it back to Brooklyn in time to change. While I was saying this, I heard three tiny beeps in the receiver.
Do what you can.
After disconnecting, I saw that the beeping was a text from Mel. Set.
I suppose this means that he's doing something for you,
my one-time sharecropper grandmother said. Yes, ma'am.
You know if I go to this thing, I gotta get my hair done.
And I know how much you love sitting in Lulu's chair.
Roger called over to her after he talked to you, and she's coming here.
I guess he really wants this date. She harumphed, and then said,
I guess. Are you being careful, Joey?
Better than that, Grandma. I'm doing what's right. 34. It took an hour and a half to get to Pleasant Plains, Staten Island. I called on the walk over from the train station. Melquoth met me at the gate of his unholy home.
How you doing?
He asked, while shaking my hand. It was a rhetorical question. My host expected a nod or maybe some non-committal phrase, but instead I stood still, considering his words.
What?
He asked. Tell me something, Mel.
What's that?
I know why I'm here at your door. My world went crazy a dozen years ago, and you are the only one crazy enough to help me through.
Okay.
You say that I was the only one ever, like that red bird you saw, to do what was right by you. But that feels like, I don't know, a little weak.
For you, it is, Joe.
It was the first time I could remember that he used my first name.
I mean, you weren't raised as the demon inside a house of piety. You never had a rapist father and a mother who hated you for it. But take my word, you didn't shoot me, and then you didn't lie. In those few years where we played chess, you just sat there like the brother I never had, the friendship I could take for granted, or the father who led me by the hand. In my world, in my mind, that was the treasure I longed for.
What about that watchmaker? Melquoth smiled sadly, and then nodded.
One day I'll tell you about him.
I hit a nerve in a man who didn't seem to have nerves. Okay, I acceded. Let's go.
You didn't answer my question.
How am I doing? A friendlier smile with the same nod. Got cold stone instead of a brain and a hornet's nest in place of a heart.
Then we're ready to begin.
On the other side of the unbreakable glass wall stood a tall man in a light tan three-piece suit.
On the floor next to him lay a metal folding chair that Melquoth had set in the otherwise bare, white cell. I figured that the man was William James Marmot, and that he had used the chair to test the unbreakability of the opaque glass wall. Now he was pacing nervously, looking everywhere for a way out. The blood from Porker's torture had been cleaned away. "How'd it go?" I asked my self-assigned friend. "I used a partner nobody had to worry about. William James had two bodyguards, so I needed a hand. He came along peacefully when they went down."
"Anybody see your face?" I asked.
"Nah."
"How should we do this?"
"You say that Antrobus knows you,"
Mel offered.
"That means if we let this guy live, that he shouldn't see your face, or your skin color, for that matter."
"Why didn't you grab Antrobus?"
"I asked around about him. He's a dangerous man, a very dangerous man. I wouldn't mind going up against him, but first, I figured we could play with Jimmy here."
Mel was wearing blue jeans, a blue T-shirt, and the white mask of a Greek god. In his left hand, he carried a long-barreled .22 pistol. Prisoner was on the other side of the cell when the bad man walked in. Marmot was a shade taller than Mel. He listed forward before Mel raised the pistol. This gesture set the security expert back a step and a half.
"What do you want?"
Marmot asked Frost.
"I need for you to tell me where Chrissy Braun is."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"An eye for an eye," Mel explained.
Marmot's lips parted.
"I told you, I don't know."
Mel lowered the pistol and shot the upright man in the left foot. Marmot yelled, fell, and at the same time threw himself at Mel. For a moment, I feared for my cohort, but Mel sidestepped the attack, pistol-whipping Marmot on the side of his head as he passed by. On the ground, the man turned into a child crying as he held his bloody and shot left foot. Mel reached into his pants pocket and pulled out a cloth bandage roll and two thick wads of cotton. These he threw at his victim.
"Take off your shoe and sock and wrap yourself up before you get blood all over my floor."
Marmot did as he was told, blubbering the whole time. When he was through, Mel said,
"I got another bandage in my other pocket. I hope you don't need to use that, too, because the next bullet goes in your left hand, and you know it's a bitch to tie on a bandage with just one hand."
"What the fuck do you want?"
"Where's Johanna Mudd's body buried? And where are you holding a living Chrissy Braun?"
If you don't let me go, my people will kill her."
Mel lifted the barrel of the gun so that it was leveled at Marmot's face. The man cowered.
"If that's true, you're as good as dead."
"Mud is buried in a church down in the West Village. It's abandoned, and the cops I worked with used it to hide the bodies they made."
That proved Marmot's collusion. I reasoned that Porker and his friends planned to bury me in that rat-infested pit.
"What about the child?"
"How do I know you won't kill me after I tell?"
"First," Mel said, gesturing carelessly with the pistol, "I can't kill you right off because you might be lying. Or maybe the girl got moved while you were crying like a baby on my floor. Second, I've been employed to find a dead woman and a live girl. You don't mean enough for me to kill."
"I don't believe you,"
the conniving child who lived in Marmot's heart said.
"Believe this," Mel replied, now aiming the pistol at our prisoner. "If I don't have the address and situation of the child in the next 3 minutes, I will start putting holes in you until either you give me what I want or bleed to death."
It was an address in Yonkers. If we were to believe Marmot, the girl was guarded by two women he knew. When he'd finished the confession, Mel thanked him and walked out of the cell.
"Are we gonna kill this one?" he asked.
"Not unless the girl's dead or he lied about where she is.
You see, if I stay working with you long enough, I might work off 9-10% of my sins. I'll be right back."
Mel left the room while I stood sentry. After maybe 5 minutes, Marmot made it to his feet, picked up the folding chair, and limped to the door. There, he stood waiting to ambush Melquoth. I hated the man for what he'd done, but still I identified with him.
Just days before, I was in a similar situation, desperately struggling to survive.
At least he's still kicking, Mel said from behind me.
I was so concentrated on Marmot's silent monologue of survival that I didn't hear my friend come in. He was carrying a small, beat-up oak table, resembling a 19th-century child's writing desk. That, and a paper folder.
You need some help?
Nah, Mel said with a shrug.
I like to use my words when I can.
With that, Mel entered and then closed the outer door. Marmot heard something because he raised the metal bludgeon chair.
Back away from the door and put down that seat,
Mel's slightly altered voice said. Marmot hesitated.
You got 60 seconds, and then I'm gonna shoot you through a hole in this door.
I fingered the scar on my cheek. Marmot threw down the chair and backed away from the door. Mel walked in, put the desk down so that it faced the window, and said,
Now pick up that goddamn chair and sit down at this table.
When our prisoner did as he was told, Mel placed the paper folder on the tabletop and flipped it open. There was a small stack of white paper with a yellow plastic mechanical pencil hooked at the spine.
You know, you don't go to somebody's house and throw their furniture around, Mel said. Now, I want you to write a confession for the murder of Johanna Mudd, the kidnapping of Chrissy Braun, and the subsequent extortion of her father. In there, I want you to name everyone you worked for and all those that worked for you, and you better include your boss and those bad cops.
Marmot began to shiver.
What are you waiting for? Mel inquired.
I can tell about the cops and my men, but I can't say who I worked for.
Even if I kill you, if you don't?
I'll be dead anyway.
Not if they put your boss away.
That will never happen.
Mel couldn't get the name Antrobus out of Marmot. The dark side security expert gave the details and the whereabouts of the kidnapped child, and he named everyone else, Porker and his friends, Valance and Pratt. Marmot facilitated the drugs and the sex slaves distributed and afforded by the cops. He threw a wrench in Mann's appeal just to keep all that quiet. His men murdered Mudd and took the child. Marmot was willing to implicate everyone but his boss. He knew that a coerced confession would never make it to open court. But if he even breathed the name of Antrobus, that would be the end of the line for him. After the confession was written, Mel had Marmot handcuff himself to the chair. Then he got behind the man and pulled his hair until his neck was exposed. He injected Marmot just like he'd done to the thug who worked for him.
What was that?
Marmot said.
Just a little cyanide to help you sleep.
Just as the dread entered Marmot's eyes, he passed out. You didn't really kill him, did you, Mel?
Nah. I just like seeing how scared a man gets when he thinks he's about to die.
35. I left Staten Island, headed for Carnegie Hall. Mel had promised to leave the unconscious crook in a place where the cops would find him first.
And I'll pin the confession to his vest, he added. They'll get the girl and find that graveyard, too.
He won't go to prison, though, I said.
If everything I hear about Antrobus is true, you won't have to worry about our boy living till spring.
The concert was lovely. My grandmother wore a red gown that sparkled from glitter and clear plastic scales.
I didn't know you even owned a dress like that, I told her.
Roger thinks his fancy gifts will get him in my pants,
she replied, with not a hint of shame. After the event was over, we went to a private gathering in an oval room that had a heavily patterned picture window for its roof. When my grandmother excused herself for the toilet, Ferris took me aside and said,
The item is on hold for you starting Monday morning. You got someone who can handle it?
Yeah. I have a friend who has a friend. Despite her protests, my grandmother was swayed by the rich white man's attentions. But I don't think it had anything to do with his money. Be it a red gown or a red ribbon, at some point, the expressions of love are all the same. Hey, babe, I said on the phone to my daughter the next morning.
Hi, Daddy. How are you? Are you okay?
I think maybe I might be the best I've ever been in my life.
Really? Is the trouble over?
For you it is. For me, it's just beginning.